I'm calling this an overview of the church at the end of the 18th century, but you could call it the declension and then revival of religion into the 19th century. And I'm going to read a quote from Heman Humphrey's work on revival sketches. And as I go, I'm going to try to break it down so that you can understand everything that he's saying. He says, passing from the glorious revival period, so after the Great Awakening of the 1740s, under the preaching of Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and the two tenets, Joseph Bellamy, and other apostolic laborers, we find the shadows of a long night settling down again upon the churches of this land. The churches are in a state of declension. Unbelief is starting to come upon the masses. So then he says, we are next to inquire, what were the causes of the alarming dearth and declension just mentioned before we hailed the dawn of a brighter day? And looking back upon that period, some of these causes are too obvious to be mistaken. First came what is familiarly called the Old French War. So I'm assuming he means the French and Indian War. Scarcely was that danger over when serious difficulties broke out between the colonists and the mother country. So he's talking about the Revolutionary War, and continued to increase till they issued in the War of the Revolution. Here again, it would have been very remarkable if in the midst of all these agitations of the then infant settlements, the country was an infant nation at the time, revivals had sprung up. He says it would have been remarkable, but they did not. Humanly speaking, there was no room for them. Everybody's emotions, everybody's thoughts were about the wars that were going on. And then finally, after the war, French infidelity, because we partnered with France in order to beat England in the Revolution, brought in their French infidelity, which our allies brought over with them. It was sowed, broadcast among our own officers and soldiers, aided by Paine's Age of Reason. I'm going to talk about all of these one by one. Voltaire's assaults upon Christianity, Volney's ruins of the empires, and other blasphemous publications that spread rapidly, especially among the upper classes. Towards the close of that period in 1789 broke out the French Revolution, the bloodiest of all revolutions, which was not only to sweep away the throne and level all the civil distinctions of society, but to destroy the priesthood, root and branch, abolish the Sabbath, and establish the reign of liberty and equality on the ruins. Heman Humphrey, Revival Sketches. There is a book that's been helpful to me, and I don't own the hardback. I'm aware of these books because of a publishing company called American Vision. And Daniel Dorchester wrote this book with so much interesting information. It's about 1,000 pages. And he says in his History of Christianity in America, to Americans, infidelity was introduced in plausible forms in connection with the ideas of liberty and self-government then very popular. Statesmen and scholars were the first victims. Dark indeed were the closing years of the 18th century. Religion was at a standstill and churches were declining. Infidelity in its most coarse and brutal form sneered at religion and scoffed at morality. The predominant sentiment of the people seemed to be, we will not have God to reign over us. Even the Methodist Episcopal Church, with all of its religious fervor, its apostolic spirit, and its evangelistic zeal, was suffering a state of decline. During the 3 years which preceded 1796, that denomination had suffered an average loss of 4,000 members annually. But anyway, Dr. Timothy Dwight was really the foe that beat back the infidelity that was coming into Yale and other places through his writings. And writing of this period, with the circumstances of which he was personally familiar, said, youths, or young people, particularly who had been liberally educated and who, with strong passions and feeble principles, were votaries of sensuality and ambition, delighted in the prospect of unrestrained gratification and panting to be enrolled with men of fashion and splendor. They became enamored with the new doctrines, all the science, all the information that had been acquired before the last 30 or 40 years stood in their view for nothing. Experience, they boldly proclaimed, applauding instructus who taught in manners, morals, and government nothing but the ABCs fitted for children only. So when Dwight got to Yale, there were about 110 students. When he left, when he moved on, there were over 300. But of that 110 students, one of 10 even had any kind of a Christian profession. At this period, Europe, which annually ships to our shores a vast quantity, I love his language here, of useful merchandise, and together with it a proportional assortment of toys and mischief, consigned to these states a plentiful supply of the means of corruption. From France, Germany, and Great Britain, the dregs of infidelity were vomited upon us, he says. And Thomas Jefferson was partly to blame. Because for a long time he yielded to the skepticism of his time. And even this General Charles Lee was noted for the boldness of his infidelity and his reckless blasphemy. In his will, he instructed his survivors not to bury him in any church or churchyard or within a mile of any Presbyterian or Anabaptist meeting house. As late as 1810, Bishop Meade said, infidelity was rife in the state, and the College of William and Mary was regarded as a hotbed of French politics and religion. I can truly say that then and for some years after, in every educated young man in Virginia whom I met, I expected to find a skeptic, if not an avowed unbeliever. Infidelity became rife in Virginia. In Virginia. And it's so amazing because of what was previously in Virginia just a short time ago. Samuel Davies and so much good that was done there by Whitfield, and now it's the infidelity center of the new nation. Perhaps beyond any other portion of the land, the clergy, for the most part, were a laughingstock or objects of disgust. So atheism in Yale College, another institution, on the election of the Reverend Timothy Dwight to the presidency of Yale College in 1795, he found atheistical clubs existing there, and infidelity in its most radical forms prevailed among the students. It was a time of great laxity of moral and religious sentiment. Young men were fascinated with radical notions of mental as well as political independence, and were much inclined to shake off what they regarded as the shackles of superstition. So that's what they're calling Christianity now, the shackles of superstition. The degree to which it prevailed may be judged from the following fact. A considerable portion of the class which Dwight first taught had assumed the names. In other words, they wouldn't call the professors by their real names, but they called them by the names of the French infidels and were more familiarly known by them than by their own. It required all the tact and eloquence of that able man, Timothy Dwight, to suppress this great evil. Dorchester says, but under his administration, it was nearly rooted out. Several revivals of religion, one of which has often been referred to on account of its power and extent, were among the effectual means of this result. And I show you this picture of Thomas Jefferson because Jefferson got hold of this book, Volney, the French man. I can't even pronounce his first name. And he promoted it. He had it translated into English. This thing that Heman Humphrey had just called this blasphemous production, and Jefferson was forwarding it. It was called The Ruins of the Empire. So the congregations, the pastors, got concerned about it, and they wrote a letter to John Adams, then president of the United States, and they referred to a very critical era in the history of the government, and illustrates the patriotism and piety of American ministers. They want this stuff to go away. They want it to end. They got to take up a stand against it. And they want the President of the United States to know how concerned they are. The atheism of France in 1795 had engulfed that empire in anarchy and blood. It was the first experiment in the history of the world of the national reign of infidelity, and its result shocked a civilized world with horror and demonstrated its terrific nature and evils on civil government and society. Robert Hull had a masterly sermon. Hull was a Baptist preacher in England. He was never in the United States, but his sermon was called Modern Infidelity Considered, and he said God permitted the trial to be made. In one country, he's referring to this country, and that the center of Christendom, Revelation underwent a total eclipse, while atheism, performing on a darkened theater its strange and fearful tragedy, confounded the first elements of society, blended every age, rank, and sex, and indiscriminate proscription and massacre, and convulsed all Europe to its center, that the imperishable memorial of these events might teach the last generations of mankind to consider religion as a pillar of society. Those who prepared the minds of the people for that great change and for the reign of atheism were avowed enemies to revelation. In all their writings, the diffusion of skepticism and revolutionary principles went hand in hand. The fury of the most sanguinary parties was especially pointed against the Christian priesthood and religious institutions, without once pretending, like other persecutors, to execute the vengeance of God, whose name they never mentioned, upon his enemies, and so on and so on. So John Adams said, written back, and he was in full agreement of what was being said. So I want to tell you about Thomas Paine. Why did Thomas Paine even have an audience? Thomas Paine was an enemy in his sentiments to King George III of England. And Paine had left England, come to the United States, and gained popularity through a pamphlet that he had written called Common Sense, which was distributed. And I believe that originally Benjamin Franklin helped to distribute it, because now they were publishing pamphlets and so on at an easier rate. And the citizens of the United States got hold of this book, Common Sense, and it helped them all sentimentally, emotionally, mentally, to take up the cause of the revolution. But Thomas Paine had gained a name for himself, but he didn't stop there. He wrote a book called Age of Reason, and he sent a copy to Benjamin Franklin. I want to show you something here, because a lot of people that attack Christianity at the foundation of this country will not admit that some of these men were God-fearing men. And whether or not Benjamin Franklin was a true Christian, if you look up the definition of deism in every dictionary up through the end of the 19th century, you couldn't say that he was a true deist. And this is a book, one of these that was published by the American Vision. This is 1,000 pages, and there's almost nothing like this for documented sources of what was written by our founding fathers in this country. And as I told you, I get up sometimes in the middle of the night on Sunday morning and take time to read stuff in preparation for my lesson. And I never found this until just this morning, but this is in this book. Benjamin Franklin got a copy of Thomas Paine's book, The Age of Reason. He sent the manuscript to Franklin and received the following reply. This is just remarkable, and I'm not even giving you the whole thing. Dear sir, Benjamin Franklin writes to Thomas Paine, I have read your manuscript with some attention. By the argument which it contains against a particular providence, though you allow a general providence, you strike at the foundations of all religion. For without the belief of a providence that takes cognizance of, guards and guides, and may favor particular persons, that's election. There is no motive to worship a deity, to fear its displeasure, or to pray for its protection. I will not enter into any discussion of your principles, though you seem to desire it. At present, I shall only give you my opinion that though your reasonings are subtle and may prevail with some readers, you will not succeed so as to change the general sentiments of mankind on that subject. And the consequence of printing this piece, The Age of Reason, will be a great deal of odium drawn upon yourself, mischief to you, and no benefit to others. He that spits against the wind spits in his own face. But were you to succeed, do you imagine any good will be done by it? You yourself may find it easy to live a virtuous life without the assistance afforded by religion. You haven't a clear perception of the advantages of virtue and the disadvantages of vice, and possessing a strength of resolution sufficient to enable you to resist common temptations. But think how great a proportion of mankind consists of ignorant men and women, and of inexperienced, inconsiderate youth of both sexes who have need of the motives of religion to restrain them from vice, support their virtue, and retain them in the practice of it till it becomes habitual, which is a great point for its security. And perhaps you are indebted to her originally, that is, to your religious education, for the habits of virtue upon which you now justly value yourself. I would advise you, therefore, not to attempt unchaining the tiger, but to burn this piece. Take this book and burn it, he's saying, before it is seen by any other person, whereby you will save yourself a great deal of mortification from the enemies that may raise against you, and perhaps a good deal of regret and repentance. If men are so wicked with religion, what would they be without it? I intend this letter as a proof of my friendship, and therefore add no profession to it, but subscribe simply yours, Benjamin Franklin. Well, Paine became so unpopular in this country due to his infidelity, though I'm going to show you that he led a number of people aside. And what I'm about to tell you is, it's scary business, the power of infidelity. But at Paine's funeral, at the end of his life, he had made so many enemies, only 6 people attended his funeral. So who is Thomas Paine? This unhappy man is well known to have been one of the most malignant enemies of Christianity. He is an avowed infidel in principle and an open profligate in practice. He lived, despised by the wise and good, and like many other infidels, died apparently full of dread of the future, though a stranger to that repentance which is unto life. I'm not going to hold back because I think it's good for us to be subjected to this. The following account of the concluding scenes of his life is from the pen of Dr. Manley, a respectable physician who attended him in his last illness. Quote, during the latter part of his life, though his conversation was equivocal, his conduct was singular, he would not be left alone night or day. He not only required to have some person with him, but he must see that he or she was there. He always wanted to have somebody in the room. He could not be left alone and would not allow his curtains to be closed at any time. And if, as it would sometimes unavoidably happen that he was left alone, he would scream and holler until some person came to him. When relief from pain would admit, he would seem thoughtful and contemplative, his eyes generally closed and his hands folded on his breast, although he never slept without the assistance of an anodyne. There was something remarkable in his conduct at this time, which comprises about 2 weeks before his death, particularly when we reflect that Thomas Paine was the author of The Age of Reason. He would call out during his paroxysms of distress without intermission, "Oh Lord, help me! God, help me! Jesus Christ, help me! Oh Lord, help me!" repeating the same expressions without the least variation in a tone that would alarm the house. It was his conduct that induced me to think that he had abandoned his former opinions, and I was more inclined to that belief when I understood from his nurse, who is a very serious, and I believe a pious woman, that he would occasionally inquire on seeing her engaged with a book she would be reading, what she was reading, and being answered, and at the same time being asked whether she would read aloud, he assented and would appear to give particular attention, and took occasion during the night of the 5th and 6th of June to test the strength of his opinions respecting revelation. I purposely made him a very late visit. It was a time which seemed to suit my errand. It was midnight. He was in great distress, constantly exclaiming in the words above mentioned, when I addressed him in the following manner. The nurse was present. "Mr. Paine, your opinions by a large portion of the community have been treated with deference. You must be sensible that we are acquainted with your religious opinions as they are given to the world. What then must we think of your present conduct? Why do you call upon Jesus Christ to help you? Do you believe in the divinity of Jesus Christ? Come now, answer me honestly. I want an answer. It's from the lips of a dying man, for I verily believe that you will not live 24 hours. I waited some time at the end of every question. He did not answer, but ceased to exclaim in the above manner. Again I addressed him, "Mr. Payne, you have not answered my questions. Will you answer them? Allow me to ask, do you believe, or let me qualify the question, do you wish to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God?" After a pause of some moments, he answered, "I have no wish to believe on the subject." I then left him, and know not whether he afterwards spoke to any person on any subject, though he lived till the morning of the 8th. How apparent is it from the preceding narration that the mind of Payne was convinced of the truth of that religion which he had ridiculed and whose author he had blasphemed, but that the stubborn pride of the hardened infidel prevented him from explicitly confessing this when the question was solemnly put to him, end quote. That's from a book called Deathbed Scenes. Voltaire. Timothy Dwight had a sermon called The Duty of Americans at the Present Crisis, July 4th, 1798. About the year 1728, Voltaire, so celebrated for his wit and brilliancy and not less distinguished for his hatred of Christianity and his abandonment of principle, formed a systematical design to destroy Christianity and to introduce in its stead a general diffusion of irreligion and atheism. For this purpose, he associated with himself Frederick II, King of Prussia, and D'Alembert and Diderot, the principal compilers of the Encyclopedia, O Men of Talents, Atheists, in a like manner abandoned. The principal parts of the system were, first, this is what he aimed at, the compilation of the Encyclopedia, in which, with great art and insidiousness, the doctrines of natural as well as Christian theology were rendered absurd and ridiculous, and a mind of the reader was insensibly steeled against conviction and duty. Number two, the overthrow of the religious orders in Catholic countries, a step essentially necessary to the destruction of the religion professed in those countries. Number three, the establishment of a sect of philosophists to serve, it is presumed, as a conclave, a rallying point for all their followers. Number four, the appropriation to themselves and their disciples of the places and honors of members of the French Academy, the most respectable literary society in France, and always considered as containing none but men of prime learning and talents, and so on and so on. I won't read any more, but tell you a story that when Dwight got to Yale Seminary, and as I said, 90% of the students were infidels. And he challenged them, and at first they tried to mock him, but he challenged them, and he said, "Let's meet together on occasion, and you ask me your questions, and we'll see if I can answer them." And Timothy Dwight was such a genius, and I'll tell you a little bit more about his story maybe in the week or two to come, but at the age of 4, he was already able to read. At the age of 6, he started to teach himself Latin. At the age of 7, he asked if he could borrow his brother's Latin works to study them. They thought he was too young, so while his brothers were at school, he just pulled them off the shelf and mastered Latin. They say at the age of 8 that he was already so mentally advanced that he could have gone to college at the age of 8, but was providentially hindered. And so this is the man that was such a force against the infidelity in those days. But to quote again, Voltaire's aim was to deny and ridicule the being of God. Government was asserted to be a curse, an authority, a mere usurpation. Civil society was declared to be the only apostasy of man. The possession of property was pronounced to be robbery. You couldn't possess property. Chastity and natural affection were declared to be nothing more than groundless prejudices. Listen to this. Adultery, assassination, poisoning, and other crimes of the like infernal nature were taught as lawful and even as virtuous actions. To crown such a system of falsehood and horror, all means were declared to be lawful, providing the end was good. Well, who's going to determine a good end when you have that kind of a moral backdrop? In this last doctrine, men are not only loose from every bond and from every duty, but from every inducement to perform anything which is good and abstain from anything which is evil, and are set upon each other like a company of hellhounds to worry, rend, and destroy. Of the goodness of the end of every man is to judge for himself, and most men and all men who resemble the Illuminati will pronounce every end to be good, which will gratify their inclinations. The great and good ends proposed by the Illuminati as the ultimate objects of their union are the overthrow of a religion, government, and human society, civil and domestic. These they pronounce to be so good that murder, butchery, and war, however extended and dreadful, are declared by them to be completely justifiable, if necessary, for these great purposes. With such an example in view, it will be in vain to hunt for ends which can be evil. So I told you that Thomas Jefferson translated Volney's Ruins of Empires. Sometime during his stay in the United States, Volney had visited here. He and Thomas Jefferson entered into a secret arrangement in which Jefferson agreed to translate Volney's Ruins of Empires into English. But Jefferson tried to keep this stuff under wraps. He knew that if this got out that he was promoting this stuff, it would ruin his name. And for a long time, Jefferson was able to hide his irreligion. In fact, his deism and some of the sentiments that he had were really never brought to light until after he had passed away. So Volney visited Monticello for 2 weeks during June 1796. The two men also met on several occasions at the American Philosophical Society. Jefferson was president of APS, whatever that is, excuse me, at a time and sponsored Volney's induction into the organization. These meetings provided the two men with ample opportunity to conceive and discuss the translation project. Thomas Jefferson, then serving as vice president under John Adams, appreciated the book's central theme, Ruins of Empires, that empires rise if government allows enlightened self-interest to flourish. This theme, Jefferson believed, represented an excellent summary of the Enlightenment-based principles upon which the U.S. was founded. However, Jefferson insisted that his translation be published only for certain readers. He didn't want everybody to read this. Due to the book's controversial religious content, Jefferson was preparing to make a bid for the presidency of the United States in 1800. He was worried his Federalist opponents would attack him as an atheist if it were known. He translated Volney's heretical book. Volney denied the human existence of Jesus. So how did these works affect professing Christians? And I have just two cases here, just paragraphs. I'm not telling you the whole story. I've narrated their whole story. Of people who had made a theological profession of orthodoxy and even called themselves Christians, but started to read Volney in pain and so on. Number one, a dying infidel, a certain individual who resided not far from Dudley in Worcestershire, was for some years a steady and respectable professor of Christianity. During his time, he was a good father, a good neighbor, and a loyal subject. A wicked man, however, put into his hands Thomas Paine's Age of Reason and Volney's Ruins of Empires. He read these pernicious books, renounced Christianity, and became a bad father, a bad neighbor, a disloyal subject, and a ferocious infidel. At length, sickness seized him and death stared him in the face. Well, the reason that I'm not going to read this at length is because his end was as bad as Thomas Paine's, as an apostate. The other one is William Pope, one of the most fearful deathbed scenes I've ever read, and I've read a lot of them. Religion being neglected, William Pope had a profession, his mind turned to politics, and these became his favorite study. Proceeding onward from bad to worse, he became the disciple of Thomas Paine and associated himself with a number of deistical persons at Bolton, who assembled together on Sundays to confirm each other in their infidelity. So going on, denominations have suffered seriously from the effects of the war. Congregations were scattered, churches had been left pastorless, and in many instances entirely destitute of religious services. Church buildings had frequently been dismantled and used as stables, hospitals, or barracks. Here's an interesting fact for you. The College of New Jersey became the University of Princeton in 1896. Just a few years before this, during the Civil War, it was occupied as barracks by the soldiers of England, and a cannonball actually went through one of the walls where they were and smashed a picture on the wall of King George II. The British soldiery seem to have had an especial spite against houses of worship on account of the influence they exerted in precipitating the struggle for independence. Church organizations, moreover, had settled down in a state of apathy, and active efforts for the propagation of religion had ceased. Worship was universally neglected, while immorality, intemperance, and vice increased alarmingly on every hand. To complete the moral degradation of the infant republic, a wave of French infidelity swept over the land. At that time, the American mind was peculiarly susceptible to this form of unbelief. The friendly relations which had existed between the colonies and France during the revolutionary struggle were favorable to the introduction of the skepticism that then prevalent in that country. The colleges of the land became infected with a deadly contagion of unbelief. Lyman Beecher, in describing the condition of Yale College prior to the presidency of Dr. Dwight, said, "Before he came, Dwight, the college was in a most ungodly state. The college church was almost extinct." Now think about that, because for a while, Jonathan Edwards had even taught at Yale College. By this time, it had gone downhill so bad. The college church was almost extinct. Most of the students were skeptical, and rowdies were plenty. Wines and liquors were kept in many rooms, and temperance, profanity, gambling, and licentiousness were common. As I said before, most of the class before me were infidels and called each other, these are the names for each other, Voltaire, Rousseau, D'Alembert. Dr. Ashbel Green, who entered Princeton in 1782, described a similar state of affairs in that college. Quote, "While I was a member of college, there were but two professors of religion among the students, and not more than five or six who scrupled the use of profane language in common conversation, and sometimes it was a very shocking kind. To the influence of the American War succeeded that of the French Revolution, still more pernicious and I think more general," end quote. William Sprague's revival lectures in the appendix. Transylvania University in Kentucky, which was founded by the Presbyterians, passed over into the hands of infidels. Thomas Cooper, a rank free thinker, taught at Dickinson College, the University of Pennsylvania, and in Columbia College, South Carolina. In all of these institutions, he scattered the seeds of unbelief in the minds of his pupils. At a later time, there was but a single professed Christian among the students of Bowdoin College. But there's good news. Just when it seemed to grow darker and darker, the night was far spent and the day was at hand. A few years before the close of the century, the light of a new revival epoch began to dawn. Here and there a church rose and shook herself from the dust. Sinners were awakened and began to inquire what they must do to be saved, so that when the old century was departing and a new century came, and many a field that had long been languishing began to rejoice under the reviving influence. Christ by His Spirit came down here and there like rain upon the mown grass and like showers that water the earth. And I rejoice at this, because this is the type of thing that we need to hope for in our own land. The publication of the Connecticut Evangelical Magazine was commenced in the year 1800. Well, June is a matter of fact, and I had come to enjoy this magazine so much. This one I had published just this week. This is called Print on Demand, and I get the book from books.google.com, and there is Schuler Books down on 28th Street has something called an espresso book machine, and they call it the espresso book machine because from the time that they get your order, print it out, cut it, and put a cover on, they create that for me in 5 minutes. And so in 2 days, if I want a copy of this magazine, and this one here is from 1802 and 1803, so this came out even before Lewis and Clark were sent to explore the Louisiana Purchase, but it's just full. The reason this magazine was created was because revival started to come so commonly, they wanted a way to chronicle it. And so they created the Connecticut Evangelical Magazine. It was at a time when God, in a remarkable manner, was pouring out His Spirit on the churches of New England. within a period of 5 or 6 years, commencing with 1797. It has been stated that not less than 150 churches in New England were visited with times of refreshing from the presence of the Lord. Narratives of quite a number of these revivals were published in the early volumes of the above-mentioned magazines. These narratives, says Dr. Porter, that's Ebenezer Porter, in his letters on revivals, were written with leisure and deliberation after the excitement connected with such scenes of thrilling interest had subsided. So Bennett Tyler, the pastor and also a college president, compiled a number of these stories, abridged them, and published them in a book called Revivals at the End of the 18th and Beginning of the 19th Century. And we'll be talking about Tyler later, because we have to do, Lord willing, a study on Asa L. Nettleton coming up very soon. But at no time since the Great Awakening had revivals wholly ceased. There was occasionally quickening here and there throughout the country, but none of them were far-reaching in their influence, and in most instances they were exceptional. Throughout the greater portion of the country, a religious indifference, coupled with the growth of French infidelity, had settled down like a great pall over the land. But about 1790... And Dwight got to Yale in 1797, and revival came there in 1800. And in fact, when Asa L. Nettleton was a student at Yale, revival came to Yale. As early as 1787, there were revivals of marked power in various parts of Virginia and Georgia. Among the earliest of these was that of Hampton-Sidney College. Well, we had just mentioned that college because that was a joint effort of James Madison and Patrick Henry had created Hampton-Sidney College, and seven of Patrick Henry's children attended there, and revival came. And it resulted in the conversion of more than half of the students. Now, this particular author, and I like this, he says that if there's two people that deserve respect during this period, it's Edward Dorr Griffin, Dr. Edward Dorr Griffin, and Timothy Dwight, president of Yale College. You cannot find an audio lecture of Edward Dorr Griffin. He's mentioned when Ian Murray does his revival series back in 1973 at Harvey Cedars, where he also did a biography of Ashbel Green. He's almost totally forgotten in our day. He was a preacher of winning personality and persuasive power, exerted a far-reaching influence over the churches of New England. At the time of which we write, he was in the full bloom and vigor of his early manhood and threw himself with all the ardor of his youthful spirit into the work of saving souls. He was born in 1770 at East Haddam, Connecticut, and graduated at Yale in 1790, after which he studied theology. So he sat under Jonathan Edwards, Jr. His earliest efforts in revival work were at the home of his father, where he was tarrying in the latter part of the year 1792. Finding himself the only professor of religion in a family of 10, he began at once to labor for their conversion. As a consequence, a revival commenced in that neighborhood, which resulted in the conversion of about 100 persons. That's from a book called A History of American Revivals, Frank Beardsley. But what do we learn from this? It is solemn because of the things that were going on in this country, that Christianity started to be abandoned. And the things that you read are pretty amazing, how infidelity had spread. But of course, we parallel this with what we're going through in our day. And we hope and we trust that as God did not forsake his churches, colleges, and so on at the end of the 18th century, and revival came again, that should be our prayer, that at this time, when we're at such a sad, sad state in this country, that revival would come again to our nation once again. And this is my hope. If that were to happen, you would want to see a group of young men that would have the ability of an Asa L. Nettleton, Timothy Dwight, Edward Dorr Griffin, and others to be able to counsel these people under awakening. But in our day, we don't even hardly study revival. And that was a conviction I had 18 months ago when I asked, after finishing teaching Pilgrim's Progress, could I do a series on revival, revivals at the beginning of the 1800s, and I discussed the Kentucky Revival, the Cane Ridge Revival, the revival, the praying revival in Manhattan of 1858, that J.W. Alexander was even in the midst of that. So in the next couple of weeks, we're going to discuss some of the amazing things that happened in revival. There's a book that was written in 1802, and that book, I've narrated some of it. It never got reprinted. The books that have been reprinted, a lot of them were done by Richard Owen Roberts Publishing. There was a revival series of 6 volumes. And some of the things are really, really amazing. Starting with the revival that came at Yale College. And there was a student who was under such intense awakening that they were afraid that he was going to die. And somebody, one of the students, went and got the college president, Timothy Dwight, to come and talk to this young man under terrible, terrible awakenings and fear. And in the other room, while all this was going on all night long, Asa Hell Neldon, a student, was pouring out his heart that there would be a good issue in this case, that this young man would be converted. And in fact, he was. And from there, we'll tell the story of Asa Hell Nettleton and how God used this man in the Second Great Awakening. And in our day, he's almost completely forgotten. And there's some people that believe that there were as many conversions under his ministries, because it just seemed that everywhere he went, revival came. That there were the types of fruits that you had under the preaching of Whitfield, and yet Nettleton's name has been, in a good measure, forgotten. And so I look forward to, for the next couple of weeks, at some of the things that we'll be discussing in this class. I'm trying to make up my mind right now. I have, and I know Doug Gentry has a copy of this, the Life of Ashbel Green. It's over 600 pages, and it was edited by Joseph Jones. And I was reading that last night on the porch, because I can put these books right on my Kindle Fire. I can take a PDF. I put it on there. I started reading this book about Ashbel Green, who became a president of Princeton University and helped to form Princeton Seminary in 1812. And I'm reading the life of this Ashbel Green, and it just struck me, the solemnity of this, that after I had come here in 1988, 1989, I was going through the used bookstore at Kriegel Books on Eastern Avenue, and I bought a set of the magazines that Ashbel Green edited, and it took me a while to find this, but in volume 2, I opened it up, and Ashbel Green's actual signature was in there. And I thought, because Doug knows this feeling, you're holding in your hand a 180-year-old book signed by the editor or the author of that book, and you feel kind of a companionship. These are men that you love. They were faithful men. And the idea of holding a book in my hand that was held in his hand, my prayer would be that his piety could be passed down to me, which I know it can't, but we do still have the same God. And I'm thankful for the means of grace that we have. 10 years ago, who would ever thought that you could print out a book in 5 minutes? And the reason I do this, there is no natural desire to reprint this stuff. It just isn't going to happen. People don't study this stuff anymore. There's so much of our national history that has been forgotten. There's no appetite for it. And yet you could read story after story of persons who were converted at that time. Revival of religion in Halifax. Revival of religion in Killinlea. And there's hymns, experiences of a pious woman, the Missionary Society of Connecticut, the There's a history in this one about our early efforts in the 1600s to reach the Indians in the colonies. But we've forgotten a lot of this stuff, and I would love to see people, especially aspirants to the ministry, have a desire to read these experimental volumes again. And with that, I'll close.